think if you're going to do something like this, you want to preserve the base rates that exist in real life. You want to give people opportunities to learn countermeasures, and you like to offer a lot of incentive to see if people could actually do this. I think a study like this could be done. I've actually suggested that a study like this be done. When President Clinton was elected, he formed a Joint Security Commission. They had a task force to look at the government's use of polygraph. I was a consultant to that group. I suggested doing studies like this then, and they haven't been done. I'll just tell you a little anecdote about that for amusement. I said, you know, what we should do is have, go to part two here, the pre-employment screening, see if people with false identities can get jobs at government agencies, and the formal response I got was the government isn't hiring now. My conclusions, there's no empirical demonstration that these types of tests work at necessarily high level of accuracy that we should insist if they're going to be used this way. I don't see the problems with the current techniques as being fixable. Despite everyone's claim that these procedures have great utility, I seriously question their utility. I don't doubt that if we went back home as academics and had to take our test for academic dishonesty, that some of us would admit things that we worry about that relate to how we fill out an expense report, or that we one time had data that wasn't consistent with the conclusion of our paper, but we didn't put it in the paper. Things like that would come up. But are these major misdeeds that justify the cost of a program like this? I don't think so. Deterrent value is an empirical question. I don't see the demonstration of it. And then most importantly, I don't see any reason why we should think that spies would not be able to use countermeasures. Dr. Hans's research shows that with relatively little effort, relatively unsophisticated people with relatively little motivation can learn countermeasures to beat polygraph tests. So what would happen when people apply a lot of effort, have a lot of motivation, and have a lot of resources at their disposal? Thank you.
So you think this is like missile defense?
Yeah, in a way it is.
Bill? In your presentation today, you didn't articulate or take a stand on underlying psychophysiological theory underlying polygraph lie detection, and Charles actually said that was a big need. Are you aware of any great articulation underlying psychophysiological theory other than some metaphorical notion of general arousal behind this?
No.
So,
Jim, there's a paper by a German fellow named Max Steller who I think took a first shot at it. I don't know if you're aware of that paper. If you're not, I'll be happy to get you a copy.
Well, my concern...
It hasn't been developed. There's been no data collected on it, but it's a place to start.
There seems... Well, I'm just trying to gauge the agreement on how far the selection of measures has advanced in 80 years, how far the technology has advanced in 50 years, and how far the articulation of theory has advanced in 80 years.
My view is very little, in that the technology has changed very little. Dr. Hunt would probably disagree, but it's the same autonomic measures that have been used 50, 60 years ago. The way it's packaged, using computers, and scoring algorithms that are computerized and whatnot, these things are different. But the flaws with the technique are with what goes into the process of producing the outcome. And so all these improvements to me are improvements. We're still basing with the same technology, the same problems that existed half a century ago.
And if I understand it, in both presentations today, there was very little discussion about the validity of the measures going in based on theory and one-to-one relationships with some psychological construct that could be arguably or theoretically abuse-related to
mind. Yeah, no, we're working at a pure empirical level.
Thanks, Bill. We're going to, if the two sessions that we've already concluded, the guide, we're going to need to have a slightly different schedule, and so I've created one. Let me tell you what the current plan is, and I need to ask Sheila when you expect to leave at the end of the day, if at all.
When you're done with me.
Okay, great. Then we have all the flexibility to do the following. We're going to skip John and have Manny's presentation now because he is the one who's leaving the soonest, I believe. And then we'll do some regrouping in the afternoon and probably save Emmett Keeler's presentation for the committee unless there turns out to be time. And we would just do that tomorrow. Perhaps an open session for those who stay around. But since his document is already in the agenda book, it's not a secret document in any sense. People have a good notion of what it is he's covered. So the next presentation is going to be by Manny Gondis. And now we're going to have to probably reboot a machine.
Is the PC on or?
Was there a zip drive on that one?
This presentation is going to be somewhat different than the previous one, because I don't know really anything about screening and very little about calligraphy in the traditional sense of calligraphy. What I will try to do is an exercise that you might consider useful, I hope. And there is, let's start from scratch. Let's say here is a physiological phenomenon that we know about. And suppose you're trying to design a screening test or any kind of application using this physiological measure, which we happen to, it's actually quite easy to record. What sort of considerations enter into the process? And suppose you didn't have 60 years of lousy work and a profession whose career is bound by the maintenance of this particular ritual, and a bureaucracy that needs a ritual for CYA activities rather than CIA activities, what would you do? I'm not sure I have the answers, but take this as a challenge for the committee. So I'll review, actually this is more a lecture about ERP research and its foundations and a little bit about what we know that might be useful to you without any pretensions that I know anything about calligraphy. I will talk a little bit about the guilty knowledge test that we have developed, mostly as an example. The word shell will come up in as a concept that I will try to introduce here. So, of course, the ultimate light detection fantasy is that somehow we get the contents of the mind. This is a cartoon from a Syrian newspaper magazine, which is, you know, what we would like to be able to do, open the head and look in. Now, I searched some time ago the web for light detection, found 671 items. All were business items. There were virtually no research among the 671 items. And psychophysiology as a discipline basically pays scant attention to calligraphy. That's not completely true. During the year, I actually served as president of SPR. A lot of my energy was consumed by disputes between two individuals about whether or not they should publish something about calligraphy, and a lot of energy and time, and basically this kind of disputes have gotten the society and most of the psychophysiology discipline away from an interest, and that's why there's very little theory. And calligraphers in general pay scant attention to psychophysiology, though there's some notable exception. So let's frame the issue. You have a given measure of bodily function, and you have two kinds of interest. You might be interested within subject variants to test theories in cognitive neuroscience, to develop assessment tools, to develop applications using the tools. That's essentially what I do and most of my colleagues do. We're interested in within subject variants. we run the same subject over multiple conditions, and we try to understand how the brain implements the mind. And then use it for practical applications, because sometimes you need funding. You're really interested in between subject variants in this, in the context of this meeting. And again, you want to develop it, psychometric tools, and somehow the word doesn't seem to come up in these discussions. This is basically a psychometric tool, and it got from nobody an excuse from psychometrics. There's a theory, there's procedures, there's notions about validity, measurement, construct validity, you name it. I mean, people make a living doing this. Some of you, in fact, do. But the theory of psychometric doesn't seem to play a serious role in what is essentially a psychometric pretense. A psychometric conceit, and it should. But we basically are trying to look at between subject variants, because we want to develop psychometric tools, because we have some theories about individual differences. And in fact, there is a domain within a classical or normative psychophysiology that does focus on individual difference, and those are people interested in clinical issues. I'll mention one or two. And in which case, actually, a lot of people's work is done on individual differences, but mostly those are categories of subjects that meet, like, first sons of alcoholics compared with non-alcoholics, without really pretending to make or intending to make any specific predictions about any specific individual, whether or not he will or will not, or she will not drink. Well, you can't use politically correct language when you talk about the sons of alcoholics, they'll all be he. And I'd say he or she. But to make inference of a specific individual is a whole different issue. Of course, as I'm sure you realize. So, for the ERPs, within subject variance is widely studied, widely used, applications are implemented, and I'll mention a few. But the application are
essentially... Sorry, what's an ERP?
Event-related potentials. I'll get that in a
minute. I told you that would happen.
Yeah. I will introduce them in a minute. Actually, it also stands for enterprise-related processing or something, and I was appointed to a committee on our campus to study our purchase of ERP, and it bothered me no end that this whole group of people are talking about my area, using my acronym for something as stupid as student records.
Hard problem too.
Now, between subject variants, for all practical purposes, is not studied. I think that's the reality of the field. It's considered noise that we try to avoid, and in fact, most. Now, for screening, there's almost nothing useful to say, as virtually no research was done. And it might be interesting to consider what would be useful research, what are the issues to address, the paradigms to use, the likely applications. So what I'll do is I'll give you a brief introduction to ERP in my sense of the acronym, and discuss the P300, which is one ERP component. What do we know? I'll discuss the concept of a shell, which is what I think is needed in order to have an application. And what can we expect in the best of all possible worlds? I don't actually have a good answer to that. And it's got some research lines. So the basic introduction, I'll be very telegraphic on this. You start with the EEG. So this is just a basic electroencephalographic record. You've got a certain number of segments here. And they're represented by the second worth of data. And at this point in time, in each of them, the tone was presented to the subject. And we know from a variety of other studies, animal work and so forth, that is this sample. Talking about work done 50, 60 years ago when this field sort of started emerging, that this brain activity, which represents all brain activity, activity affecting the particular pair of selectors in which I'm recording includes within it a specific response to the tone, known as an evoked potential. So that's the potential, that those are the activities that were generated in the brain and various brain structures by the tone, and they happen to be very small relative to the rest of brain activity.
Okay, you've had one event and you're averaging over different places in the brain?
No. This is the same event repeated from the same pair of electrodes.
Okay, so you did something many times and you're averaging
exactly,
over the time.
Exactly. Oh, okay. What you're seeing here is a set of records that are aligned by the time at which the tone was presented.
Okay.
The whole technique is based on the fact that the evoked potential has a fixed time course.
Okay.
And the rest of the brain has a random time course. The rest of brain activity is randomly varying relative to the triggering event. So, by the miracle of signal averaging, if I take an average of this record, by getting a magic box called an averager, I get an estimate of the response of the brain to this particular tone. And that's the evoked potential. That's the object we're studying. We're studying specific responses of brain structures to specific events. And what needs to happen is that the same event, in some sense of, in a certain sense of saying, it can actually be very different physical event that would, as you'll see, that would still be the same event. The time of occurrence must be known with absolute precision, and the time course of the event must be fixed, which is always true, but it's sort of, that's the basic assumption of averaging. I get a signal that would be somewhere between 1 to 10 microvolts, sometimes less than that. And it lasts over, I'm showing here about 500 milliseconds, actually, so you'll see it can last for seconds. There's a whole range of things going on. And when I, now, the basic assumption and basic structure of the signal is, the assumption is that as an event occurs, different parts of the brain get activated depending on what needs to be done about the stimulus. And they happen in different structures, and I put out the slide that described that because the cortical neurons tend to be organized in parallel, and because many of them are activated in synchrony by the nature of the beast, the individual dipoles that are created around an individual neuron when it's active tend to be repeated many times over by many neurons who happen to be aligned. And if that's the case, the many, many dipoles add up and I get a dipole large enough to be recorded on the scalp. So the basic assumption is somewhere for any activity that we can see is activity that is activated, a sufficient number of parallel neurons that have been activated in synchrony at a particular point in time, and they generate a dipole that can be recorded on the scalp. And so this is not a unitary phenomenon, sort of an oscillating wave. This is basically a sequence of activities that can take place in many different places. They're called components. And the assumption is that the component represents some specific intracranial activity. And that's a fairly well-established assumption. That is, it's well supported by data. I don't have time to review it. There's also the assumption, which rests largely on faith, that everything that happens in the brain serves an information processing function. That is, that these evoked potentials are not generated in the brain so that I can publish papers and advance my career, and they're also not there to just, you know, waste time. The brain does things in order to process information. So each one of these activities has some kind of
function in the information processing transactions of the brain. And our, the challenge, the research challenge for people who study ERPs is to try to identify the components, and we'll talk about this in a minute, and for any identified component to try to understand the intracranial source, identify the intracranial sources, which is very difficult to do, and also to understand the functional significance of the component. That's to try to develop a psychological theory or an information processing model that would explain what this particular component is doing. And that's the database. Now, we enter the task of developing applications with actually a fairly well-developed knowledge about which components can be recorded. There are many. Some of them are very interesting, at least to me, but actually to a fairly large community. And the knowledge that's accumulated by them over the last 30, 40 years is actually quite substantial. And they can be recorded with relative ease, quite a bit of reliability, and we'll talk about this in a minute. Okay, so just the terminology, the labeling is P for positive, N for negative, and a number which is usually the number of milliseconds following the components. In Illinois, negative is up and positive is down. It will be unfortunately the case if you enter into this literature that you'll find about half the world thinks that negative is down and positive is up. And we have all agreed over and over again in meeting after meeting that we should use a common standard. But like India and Pakistan, we also agree, each of us, that our convention is immutable and cannot be changed. So the only convention which exists that is common in the field, if you read this literature, is that the calibration signal in the figures should show where positive and negative go. And you have to be careful to watch it. And this tends to be the case. But in everything I'm showing you now, positive is down and negative is up. Now, there are two classes, general classes of event-related potential components. One is not quite interesting in our context. Those are very early activity that really represent the passage of information through the early sensory pathways. So if you present an auditory stimulus to a subject, if the subject is alive, the brainstem is intact, and the equipment works, you'll get about 9 little potentials over the first 9 milliseconds or so. They're enormously useful to neurologists, because if something is wrong with those, you know something is wrong with the brainstem, with the auditory part of the brainstem. So almost every hospital now has, in the radiology and in the neurology clinic, a way of studying brainstem potentials. They're completely invariable psychological variables. Nothing changes them. They're just like the post office. Nothing will stop them from coming. No. Tension, sleep, coma will not stop them from happening. Just a damaged brainstem. There's another class of components. Let me give you 3 sentences. Just read carefully. Okay? Now, you didn't realize that, but when this appeared on the screen, your brain responded in a very specific way. And you don't feel the ERPs, but they happen. A component called the N400, N for negative, 400 for about the latency, appears in response to a work that is semantically incongruous in the sentence. And there's a whole range, a lot of people are spending a lot of energy trying to understand exactly what happens, what is the nature of the cognitive activity that is triggered by the word cry, The kind of work that people do is illustrated here. You see the word drink? It also elicits an N-400, but it's smaller than cry. Now why? I mean, you never drank a pizza. At least I don't know of. It's an ending that's equally stupid as the pizza was too hot to cry. But drink and eat are semantically related. Drink and eat, that's the theory explaining this data. Because drink and eat, and because eat is the expected ending, and drink falls within the semantic network of the expected ending, the N-400 is somewhat smaller. The kind of, you know, to be oversimplistic about this, what people will tell you is that the N-400 represents the amount of work necessary to integrate the word into the sentence, and you benefit from the semantic distances, from the short semantic distances, so you need to do less work to integrate drink than to integrate cry. I'm only doing this to illustrate the nature of the work that people do in order to understand the functional significance of this component. It's not enough to say, here's an incongruous ending. That was sort of the beginning of the work. When Kutas and Hilliard, who first reported this thing, they use sentences like that to say the last word of the sentence, does it? But it turns out that it's very complicated and we don't have time to talk about it, but it's the kind of thing people do. There's probably several hundred papers by now, if not thousands.
We'll go back to the example that shows. What would the event actually be? Would it be the initiation?
It's the initiation, the appearance of the word cry. The words are presented, the way they're doing this experiment, the sentence is presented almost the way I showed it. One word at a time showing up on the screen, and the computer is triggered by the appearance of the last word. This will happen with ASL sentences, so pictures of ASL hand movements, or movies of ASL.
Sorry, what's ASL?
American Sign Language,
okay.
A deaf language. So the triggering on the appearance of the frame with the right kind of gesture will produce exactly the same N-400.
What about words, verbal?
I'm sorry?
When it's not appearing on the screen, but someone is speaking the word.
Same thing. You'd have to trigger on the sound of the word. Now there's a problem there which is actually interesting as you think about the problematics of using that. The whole technique is based on the notion of synchrony between the events. The recognition, and what they do in an experiment like that, there'll be many, many different sentences. They don't repeat the word cry. They'll have many sentences, each ending with a different incongruous ending, and many sentences ending with a congruous ending, and many sentences ending with an incongruous ending that is semantically related to the critical word. And they average all this many different words. Now, if you do it visually, the synchrony is very good because the word appears always at the same time. If you do it auditorily, the exact instant at which the word is perceived varies across the words.
See, I'm trying to think about asking questions to which you think people might be right. What's the timing on that?
Okay. Well, this is, you're going in exactly the right direction. I mean, basically, you'll have to invent, if you want to use N-400 in any kind of concealed knowledge or screening or diagnostic testing or emotional assessment or whatever, you'd have to develop a shell. And one of the choices you have to make is to think, should I use visual or auditory stimuli? And a little technical detail that makes visual a little better than auditory is that the synchrony between successive words is going to be better because where in the envelope of the sound we actually detect the word is a lot more variable than when we present a word on the screen, which, you know, is seeing it. So there's this little engineering detail of which has to do with the nature of signal averaging. Now we have developed, and other people have developed, ways of getting around the latency jitter in the detection of the words, and if you have to use something where latency varies, then your technique, your tool should include a way of dealing with the latency jitter, because there's no avoiding it. I mean, if you have something with variable timing, the amplitudes are going to be smaller.
I'm asking you a question you might lie to. The point in the sentence where you recognize, where I would recognize the question as something that I am nervous about and am going to lie to, something that would be almost impossible to time precisely.
Well, I'm not sure the N400 would be the best tool for this particular thing. So, but this might allow you to detect if a person has certain basic knowledge that, for example, if I would deny knowing Hungarian and I give N400 to the ending of Hungarian sentences, then there's just no way under the sun I would be able to know this difference without knowing Hungarian. So you can categorically establish that I know Hungarian by developing such a test. You can tell me that what I have to do is monitor whether the word on the screen is green or red, but the words form Hungarian sentences. Or you do a lexical decision task. I mean, there's a lot of little games you can play, but as you'll see, there are many of these. This is just one of many things, and for each one of them, you can come up with this kind of question. And it's possible to develop the tools. It's just the problem is that nobody wants to pay for them.
So is this or these, is this purely semantic response, or for instance, would it, is it, does it exist in music
or programmer
sequences or visual?
No, it's purely semantic. It doesn't work in music. In fact, we've done a lot of work in our lab, and Besson and Marseille has done work on that. Violating musical expectancies generates P300, which I haven't introduced to you yet, but not N400. Grammatic violations generate a P300, not an N400. This seems to be a purely semantic, linguistic process. Marta Kutas at San Diego is the pioneer of discovery this thing, and she and her students have done a lot of work on it. I'm using it because Marta was my student, so I'm proud of that, and because it's a very cute example to explain.
Here's a question for you. The 400 refers to when it occurs. What does the N refer to?
Well, negative.
Oh. So it's
N is negative and P is positive, and the number is about 400 milliseconds. And it's the P that we're talking about, not the onset. The onset is a little difficult to measure, so people are, the latencies are amazing in terms of the P. Okay, so there are really two classes of brain processes that are monitored by ERPs, the exogenous ERPs, which are the sensory-dependent energy delivery, which sensor organ, what intensity, which physical characteristics. They usually appear in the first 150 milliseconds, and they're relatively insensitive to the task of the subject and the attention of the subject. The so-called endogenous components, things that the brain generates from within it to meet its own information processing needs, tend to depend on information processing tasks. Attention makes a difference, task events make a difference, they depend on the context. They're relatively insensitive to the physical properties of the stimulus. This is what I just told you. You can get the N400 with auditory language, visual language, hand gesture language, whatever. So most of this activity deals with the structure of the information the subject is getting and is activated by the nature of the information processing rather than by the physical properties of the stimulus. Now, the component is an important concept. I'm not going to get into the details of that. Just to say that basically we're dealing with it by defining the subsegment of the total variance in the data we record that behaves in a systematic manner in response to experimental variables. So a component of the ERP is defined in three attributes. One is the relative range of time at which it appears. Second is the distribution over the scalp, because different electrodes you know, because the thing is happening inside the head, it will be distorted over the scalp as a function of its location. So different components will have different scalp distribution. That's the key defining attribute. And the other thing is the response to experimental variables. So the N400 is defined by the fact that it responds to semantic properties of the stimulus and its relation to the context. Let me just say, as an aside, that it's not easy to infer the actual location of the dipole from the skull distribution because of the properties of the brain and of the signal of the skull. But actually, nowadays, there are ways of getting around those difficulties. So, this technique gives you excellent temporal resolution, but pretty lousy spatial resolution in terms of where things happen in the brain, even though right now we're in a process, in a period where even this statement is not completely true. And there's a huge vocabulary of such events. I won't spend the time discussing them, just say that each one of these is one such component. Most of them are related in some way, for reasons which may or may not be interesting, there's something funny that's happening. They're all deviance related. Either incongruous sentence, surprising events, the commission of errors, something completely novel happening, mismatch between an event and the previous events. Somehow, the vast majority of the known ERP components are somehow deviance related. So what do we need to know? We need to know the antecedent conditions. We need to know what do I need to manipulate in order to get the component to appear and to change its amplitude or latency. So I need to know how the variance controls. I need to know the biophysical origins. I need to know the neural circuitry. And that's an important thing to distinguish. That is, this dipole that generates it may very well be an element in a complicated brain circuitry, some of which I can't see with my technique, but it's actually part of what's going on. So if you stick electrodes inside the head, you might find other areas active at the same time as the generating source is active. So there's there are essentially two different study questions. One is to find the dipole, the other is to understand how this particular brain that generates the voltages interacts with the rest of the brain. And we need to know the functional significance, which is what does it do in terms of information processing. Because the basic conceit I have is the brain is not an organ whose function is to move ions across gates and generate chemicals. Its function is to process information, and it's using all this apparatus in order to process the information. So as a psychologist, I'm interested in functional significance. Now, here is a piece of data that's relevant to our discussion. This we published in 1964. It's a very old study, and we just ran the same subject. In those days, you actually used the subject initial, so there was a 3 graduate students. And just in response to the same physical stimulus over several weeks, over and over again. And you see two interesting things. One is that you get substantial difference across the subject. Two is that within the subject there is actually a fair level of consistency. And to some degree, if you do the variance and the necessary analysis, you'll identify homogeneous components across the subject. They'll be identified in terms of what happens over a given area of time relative to the scalp distribution and how this particular wave responds in the same way across the subject. So it's this kind of data that convinced us and many other people that in this business we have to deal with in-subject experiments. That you cannot just run large groups of subjects and average over the subjects. You have to measure the changes within the subject and then somehow pull the results across subjects. So as a consequence of that, that's what I just said,
There's relatively no data on individual differences in the field because mostly in many of the experiments that people do in my kind of work, the number of subjects is not large, 10, 15 subjects, you know, maybe 40. Now, the clinical domains in which, so Gleiter and his colleagues have been studying the T300 in alcoholics for the past 30 or 40 years, and they actually have done, at some point, they have a multi-laboratory study that accumulates alcoholic sons over a large group. Bill has done work on twins, and that also is an individual difference study. But those are sort of the major individual difference studies that exist. And they were driven by a specific interest. And there's a lot of work on schizophrenics, on things like that. But so one of the things we need to understand is what are the sources of individual difference, the kind that I've just shown you. One of the problems, of course, is that we are pretty lousy in determining where our electrodes are relative to the brain. The basic technique is you place electrodes relative to skull landmarks. So you measure the skull with great precision and you divide it into areas of proportional circumference and you place the electrode. There's an international system of placing EEG electrodes developed in the 50s by Jesper and colleagues, and it's been used ever since. Now, they developed this technique on the basis of the study of cadavers, where they've actually established that using this coordinate system for the skull does actually get the electrodes placed within an inch or so, or something like that, of brain landmarks. But there's huge variability across people, different head shapes, and one would assume that the brain is differentially related to the skull in different people. So recording from the same subject in the same coordinate system, from the electrode identified identically in the coordinate system, may be related to different places of the brain in the different subject. But most of our kind of work, it doesn't really make a big difference, because you can move the electrode by half an inch or an inch, it will pick up the same data. But if you get involved in individual differences, it becomes an issue, and partially the kind of example I gave you with the three subjects that we ran, this might in part be due to skull-brain relationship. The differences in the level of background noise, I'll show an example. That is, the ongoing EEG may be different subject at different times. So what subjects do while they're sitting being tested, and when they're doing nothing else than looking at sentences, has to do with what they think about, what their brain does, what kind of pathology they have, who knows. How sleepy they may get, yeah.
I was wondering, for example, in your N400 example with words that are incongruous, is there an equivalent of countermeasures, for example, if the subject thinks of a congruous word when the incongruous one is presented, or vice versa?
It depends, in terms of where I'm going to get to, it depends on the shell you constructed. And you have to construct the shell in a way that will take into account possible countermeasures and deal with them, and I'll illustrate it with the P300. So it's never going to be, I think that's my main thesis, never going to be, you take the experiment that we published and you run a lie detection test on it. You've got to go through a design process that takes all we know about the measure and its interactions with other things and create a narrative around it that you can do a test that might be useful. And the quality of the application depends on the quality of the shell, not alone on the base. That the shell, an empty shell will do you nothing. So, I mean, the shell has to contain some real useful knowledge about some component, but the nature of the shell you construct is critical.
accelerate variance in processing, cross-subject variance in latency jitters. A lot of the cognitive components depend, as you'll see in a minute, when we talk about the P300, I have to categorize events before P300 is elicited. The variance in the categorization time is going to vary the latency of P300 across trials and between subjects, and that makes a difference. And of course, pathologies make a difference. It turns out that almost everything bad that can happen to you reduces the amplitude of the P300. It's sort of a major icky index. I mean, if you're schizophrenic or depressed or nasty or whatever, you get a lower P300. Age makes a difference. Age makes a difference in latency. I'll pass on to you the information that your latency slows about a millisecond of a year over your life. Not very much, but a millisecond a year is a millisecond a year. And there's also changes in the distribution. We don't have time to talk about that. It's an interesting study. And so, now here's an example on the noise. This is also from way back 1965. Those were the days when we sent in the paper on ERPs, and the editor said, what would happen if you don't give a stimulus? How do you know that you really have a sensory evoked potential? So we are required to submit what happens when we trigger the averager without any stimulation. What it shows is over these four subjects, the residual noise is actually quite variable. This is all the same scale, same everything, horrible, and quite a bit of background variance. Nobody asked for this anymore, but it makes a difference. So now let's introduce the P300. This is elicited by the so-called oddball paradigm, which we'll talk about for the rest of the discussion. So here is the oddball paradigm. You take a sequence of events, and I'm specifically saying events and not stimuli because they can be very complicated. They can consist of multiple things happening or things that change their meaning depending on what the subject is doing and so forth. You add a classification rule so that each event falls in one of two categories. And again, the classification rule can be very complicated. We've done studies in which we showed people all the covers of time and usement for a year, and the categorization rule was politician versus everything else, or performer versus anything else. So the stimuli were very different from each other. The categorization rule was relatively complex.